Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with James M. Lundberg, author of the book Horace Greeley, Print, Politics, and the Failure of American Nationhood. Jake, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
Well, thanks for agreeing to be on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
I'm an assistant teaching professor and the director of undergraduate studies in history at the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana. So I teach classes in U.S. history, and I direct our undergraduate program in history.
What was it that led you to write a book about Horace Greeley?
So this is a project that goes back to graduate school. This was my dissertation. Very, very different product from the book. But I became interested in Greeley when I was reading for my comprehensive exams in my third year of graduate school. And I had to read Daniel Walker Howe's book, The Political Culture of the American Whigs, which has a half chapter about Horace Greeley. And I just became totally fascinated by this very bizarre character, a newspaper man who was part intellectual, part politician, part celebrity. And it seemed like there really wasn't all that much out there about him at the time. Now, I wasn't the only one to see this, and there were some other books that came out while I was working on the project. But the work that did come out didn't, I don't think it really got at what I was most interested in, which was the print and journalism angle. This is something that I'd been really interested in going all the way back to college. I had been very taken with Benedict Anderson's book about nationalism, Imagined Communities, as many people have been taken with that book. And Anderson talks about newspapers as this kind of key cultural infrastructure in the making of modern nations, which as a young college student, I thought was such a cool conceptual idea. And somehow stuff that I was really interested in all came together in Greeley. And I went with it.
I have to say that is one of the things I enjoyed about your book was how you explore Greeley at this really pivotal point in the emergence of American journalism, this transition from it as being something of an elite press to being something of a mass press, and the role that he assumes in this, how he envisions himself. It's difficult to think of many people who preceded him who had a similar oracular role, who were seeing themselves as not just producers of entertainment, but people that were essentially just as public oracles who were seeking to, establish this vision. And I especially like as well how you make it clear it's not just that he sees himself as a person who's going to spout off on the issue of the day, but he has a very, he has a vision that you identify and trace over the course of this very long career in journalism.
Yeah. So, Yeah, I think oracular is a good word for how Greeley sees and understands himself as a newspaper man, and how he sees and understands journalism. So you mentioned that he comes up in journalism at this moment when the popular press is absolutely exploding. So he's in New York City, kind of at the moment of creation for the modern popular press. There are these new, very cheap daily newspapers that are coming out, the New York Sun, later on, a little bit, a couple years later, the New York Herald. And these are papers that are incredibly, incredibly popular and show, you know, this great potential of the press as this very, very popular medium. And yet to Greeley, they're horrifying because they're full of all kinds of kind of lowly, what he sees as lowly content. They're taking these stories and they're kind of scraping them from the underbelly of urban life, something that Greeley is kind of horrified by, even though he willingly moved to New York City. and so he thinks that the press is this incredibly powerful tool for kind of elevation, for instruction, for unifying people and kind of bringing them together and giving them kind of the correct political views and ideas. But he sees it as being kind of bastardized by these popular newspapers. And so that's really the genesis of his vision for himself as an editor. It's something that he develops and articulates in response to this kind of revolution in the popular press that is going on around him.
I was wondering if you could maybe take us back a bit. How does Greeley get into journalism, and then how does he get to New York? From where is he coming?
Yeah. So Greeley is a New Englander originally. He was born into a kind of declining farm family in New Hampshire. As a child, his father, when Greeley was a child, his father lost their farm in a place called Amherst, New Hampshire. And from there, the family kind of bounced around northern New England on rented and very, very unproductive farms. Greeley very much resented his parents as people who were on the wrong side of these massive economic changes that were happening in the beginning of the 19th century. He sees them not as victims of these changes, but as kind of personal failures. And so, you know, he becomes this kind of Whig modernizer striver type, where he sees them as these backward people who have just failed to keep up with the times. And when he's a teenager, he kind of splits with the family. We don't know that much about his early life because there's very little documentation about it. But while the family is in Vermont, he kind of splits off from the family and becomes apprenticed to a printer in this tiny, tiny town in Vermont that happens to have a newspaper that's called the Northern Spectator, and the town is called East Pulteney, Vermont. And you know, he works as an apprentice, and he works this paper for a few years. You know, if you are a young printer, in the late 1820s, 1830s, he goes to New York in 1831. New York is a good place to go. As I said before, this is New York to him is this kind of complex and terrifying place, one that he really never got comfortable with. But it was a place that was exploding in print, in journalism, and so it's a good place to go if you're a penniless printer from the sticks who has memorized Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. He goes to New York City in 1831. He works in various print shops, first as, you know, just as a kind of journeyman printer. He tries his hand at a couple of failed ventures, including a short-lived daily newspaper, before he founds a weekly paper called The New Yorker, which is kind of news and literary weekly, nothing to do with the modern New Yorker. This is a paper that's kind of modeled on the weekly newspapers that he grew up with, and that he worked on while he was an apprentice. So that's kind of how he gets started.
This is also, I think, a good point which we can talk about a bit, his involvement with politics, because this is something mm-hmm. that it's fascinating how we have this throughout American history, this ever evolving dynamic between publishing, print, journalism on the one hand, and then the political scene on the other. And you describe not just his efforts and labors as a journalist and an editor, but you're also talking about this engagement that he has with politics, which in some ways is very surprising today. I mean, you have him actually getting elected to Congress at one point. You have him running for various public offices or aspiring to various public offices mm-hmm. without success. So we're talking about a person who is not a, quote, journalist in the sense of just being only a journalist or only an editor, but we're talking about a person who is really a very public figure in a lot of different ways.
Yeah. He's a figure that I think, maybe 20 years ago, maybe 25 years ago, would have been harder to place because we've tended to see journalism as being kind of a realm of objectivity or aspirations to objectivity, kind of separate from the workings of politics. Now, that has obviously changed very, very dramatically with the rise of the internet and the rise of kind of partisan television networks and so on. So we can kind of understand what he was a little bit better in a way nowadays, or in the present moment. But you're absolutely right. He was a figure who saw his journalism as being very, very political, and being really essential to the workings of politics. In particular, for him, he was promoting the policies and ideology of the Whig Party, and so he does kind of bleed over into the political realm, and he uses his power and this kind of celebrity that he gets in order to do that.
It's also, I think, important to note, as you do in the book, that it's not just about identifying with the cause in the sense of getting a readership, but that it's also can be very financially important because, as you explain in the book, he's not much of a businessman.
No, he's a terrible businessman. Right up to the end of his life, the end of his life, he's basically, you would think that he would have made a lot of money. And he really hasn't, because he's a terrible businessman. But early on in his career, he's caught between these two paradigms of journalism. One, a kind of older paradigm that is very much tied to the kind of operations and organization of political parties, where newspapers are party organs and they're kind of supported by political parties. But he's moving into an age where newspapers are becoming independent. So like those penny newspapers or cheap newspapers that I mentioned earlier, they're independent of political parties. They're supported just by their sales on the street and their subscriptions. And Greeley, as this political editor, is kind of caught between these two business models. Ultimately, he does succeed in making the New York Tribune the newspaper that really made him famous and was his major platform. He does succeed in making that independent of party organization, but it's something that that takes some doing.
That's where I thought it was really interesting getting into that part of the book, which is that you describe how people were making it profitable, like Bennett with the New York Sun, and it was much more of the sensationalism. It was much more of the dirty underbelly of New York, as you put it, and how this is the kind of thing that was off-putting. And so with Greeley, it seems like he is bringing a bit more of a older aesthetic and showing how it can profit in the then modern, 1830s, 1840s, publishing marketplace in New York City.
Right, exactly. He wants to show that you can have a kind of a newspaper that can succeed in the marketplace without playing to the kind of base interests or low grade tastes of the masses, that you can have a kind of elevating and uplifting newspaper that can also survive on its own. So in the prospectus of the Tribune, when he's about to start it, he calls it, I think, a paper that should be welcome at the family fireside or something like that. When he founds the New Yorker, his first weekly newspaper, he says, he has a line about how there are people who tell us we cannot succeed without humbug, which is kind of, for him, describes the kind of untruthful, sensationalized workings of the popular press. And he says, we respond to those people, we shall try. And this is, you know, this is precisely what he wants to do. He wants to succeed without humbug. He wants to succeed without this, this low level content that is just playing to, the masses.
So what was the New York Tribune like as a newspaper, and to whom did it appeal in terms of readership?
Yeah. So the New York Tribune is a very funny thing, because it's called the New York Tribune. But its real base of support was outside of New York City. Again, Greeley has this very funny relationship with New York. It's this place that he absolutely needs. He needs it in order to become the kind of figure that he becomes. But it's also a place that he kind of despises, and that, let's be honest, doesn't really have a huge constituency of people who are kind of into what he is trying to do. So the Tribune is never all that popular within New York City itself. It has this daily edition that has, you know, a modest circulation, but not a circulation that matches Bennett's New York Herald. But he has this huge base of support outside of New York City in a weekly edition. So every week, Greeley and his editors produce a kind of weekly digest of the Tribune, the Weekly Tribune, that goes out through the mail to places all across the country, especially in the North, mostly in the North, and has this huge following of people, extending from Northern New England into the kind of Yankee parts of the Midwest, all the way out into Iowa and Wisconsin. And these people kind of worship Greeley. They see Greeley in a lot of ways as the oracular figure that he imagines himself to be. They think that he writes every word of the newspaper, which is not true. But they really see Greeley as this kind of voice. It was said that the farmers and tradesmen in these far flung places that would have had subscriptions to the New Yorker, that there would be three things that they would read: their Bible, their Shakespeare, and their Tribune. What if I can indulge you with one more story about this?
Oh, please do.
Ralph Waldo Emerson was out on a speaking tour in 1854, as people like that did. He took a speaking tour to all the different lyceums and public forums around the country, and this was a reliable way to make money. And he's way out in the Midwest, and he's writing a letter about this experience to the Scottish thinker Thomas Carlyle, and he notes that he's kind of like a week behind Horace Greeley on this speaking tour. And he's just amazed and astonished at the crowds that Greeley is getting and the kind of buzz that Greeley is getting. And he tells Carlyle that Greeley is the spiritual father of these people, and that he does all their thinking in theory at a rate of $2 a year.
That's a great line. So you have Greeley as a figure, and you make it point in the book of noting that, you know, we see him predominantly as a northern figure, and this gets to something that you argue later in the book. But you also note that he does have a readership in the South, that while he becomes an incredibly controversial figure in the South in the 1850s, that you note by the correspondence he received in the South from the Southerners that he was actually, you're reaching out to an audience there as well.
Well, that's certainly what he hoped. And I think he does have a small readership. It's very, very hard to kind of gauge exactly what that readership was. There's all kinds of anecdotal evidence that Southern postmasters would refuse to deliver the Tribune to the people who had paid for their subscriptions. There are stories of copies of the Tribune being doctored to look like the New York Herald so that they can trick the postmasters and get it out to these people in the South. It's very hard to quantify what the readership is, but Greeley kind of divines this readership. He has this idea that there's this kind of mass of people in the South, especially the non-slaveholding yeomanry, who are desperate for something like the New York Tribune and are the kind of natural constituency of the Tribune. And these are these people, if you can just get them the Tribune, if you can just get them the information and the ideas that they need, they will topple the planter class. They will topple the slave power. So like a lot of Republicans, Lincoln was the same way. He had this kind of sort of misplaced faith in the Southern yeomanry. And so anything that Greeley gets from the South and from these people who he thinks are out there in these great masses, he interprets as evidence that there's this kind of revolution that's just waiting. If you can just get them the Tribune.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This is relevant to what you're examining in the book, because you're not just talking about how Greeley is functioning as an editor, you're talking about this vision that he develops, that he advocates for, that he promotes in the pages of the New York Tribune of American nation. What exactly is this vision of nationhood that he has, and how does he develop it in over the course of the 1830s, sure, 40s, and 50s?
Sure. Well, I guess the place to begin is to just say that like a lot of Americans in the 19th century, Greeley understood the United States, the American nation, in kind of providential world historical terms. You know, America was destined to stand as this model of liberty and self-government for the rest of the world to follow and emulate. But at the same time, there are these internal problems. You know, 40, 50, 60 years after the Revolution, there are all these ways in which American nationalism feels incomplete, not fully realized. It's not this kind of organic idea or experience that it is for European nations. You know, it's beset by these regional differences and these sectional tensions, particularly over slavery, that keep on cropping up. And so, you know, in the world that Greeley grows up in, and in the print culture that Greeley grows up in, you know, I think there are really these ways in which American nationalism is oriented around the project of making the nation whole, oriented around kind of resolving these problems and contradictions of American nationalism. And so, you know, I really think that his theory of journalism as a kind of unifying and nationalizing force comes out of that, comes out of the kind of powerful and yet at the same time weak and kind of contradictory nationalism of the early republic, and the print culture that is very much geared toward trying to fix those problems and contradictions. So he kind of takes that and puts it into a popular journalistic platform.
What makes this so vitally important, as you point out in the book, is that he's doing this, though, at a time when you're seeing this growing sectional impetus over the issue of slavery. And that's the tension that in those chapters that I thought was really fascinating, how he is promoting this vision, and he never loses this vision. He holds fast to this vision through his entire life. And yet he, at the same time, is trying to reconcile it with his response to this issue, which he doesn't shy away from, but he's trying to it's sort of like he's got the square peg and he's trying to ram into the round hole, and he does it in print for decades.
Yeah. I mean, I think that gets really interesting in the midst of the sectional crisis of the 1850s. Greeley, you know, there's kind of this great irony of the story of Greeley in the 1850s. He does exactly what he sets out to do in a lot of ways in that decade, in the midst of the sectional crisis, which is to create a community, what he called as a young journalist, a community of thought and feeling among people through print, through journalism. Obviously, there are other things. Other important things happening politically, the formation of the Republican Party and so forth. But he's a really, really important figure in kind of helping to use Benedict Anderson's language, to imagine the community of the North, imagine the community of the Republican Party through his journalism. And so he becomes a kind of oracle in that process. But as you say, he becomes a sectional oracle. He becomes an oracle to one part of the country, and in a way that really accelerates the growing sense of difference between North and South. He becomes a flashpoint for Southerners in helping them to imagine the North as a separate and distinct thing.
That's one of the things that I thought was really fascinating. I did appreciate you because there's. You have also all these more focused abolitionist editors, people like William Lloyd Garrison, who are publishing and who are the subject of much Southern ire. But as you point out, while Greeley himself is not a supporter of slavery, he's not as strident on this. And yet many Southerners, as you identify, they find Greeley to be the more objectionable figure in some ways.
Absolutely. They're certainly aware of William Lloyd Garrison. They're certainly aware of the abolitionist movement. But in a way, Greeley is more frightening because he has this incredible platform, because the Tribune has this massive circulation across the North. And so they project a lot of their fears and ideas and kind of horrors about the North and what they see as this kind of fanatical abolitionist North onto Greeley, because Greeley is so popular and has such a huge platform.
I thought it was interesting as well how you examine how this conflict shapes Greeley's nationalism. How I love the way you defined it in the book, where you're talking about how he develops a sectional ideal of American nationalism. You know, it's much more, which is too understandable to a degree, which is, you know, he's reflecting his background, it's a Yankee concept, but it's one in which he's basically sort of wanting to see the entire nation writ large as embodying that relatively parochial concept.
Absolutely. And this is something that goes back to his kind of hopes and dreams for the Southern yeomanry. He sees those people as kind of dormant or sleeping Yankees. There's people who just need Greeley or somebody else to kind of tell them who they are. So absolutely, it's this projection, you know. But it gets into what is a bigger theme in the book, this just larger problem of what American nationalism is in the 19th century. In a lot of ways, the impossibility of American nationalism, because nobody can really agree on what it is.
Now, your description of Horace Greeley, when I was reading it, reminded me of another figure who had a very similar background, which was Abraham Lincoln, in the sense that he comes from a family of what you might think of as a failed farmer, who develops a Whig identity from this, and who then goes into politics. And you have this point at which, when Lincoln becomes president in 1860, I was expecting Greeley to, you know, welcome him with open arms, to see him as a kindred spirit. But what you describe, when Lincoln becomes this national figure, and more specifically when he becomes president, is Greeley isn't quite as accepting of Abraham Lincoln. You describe a tension that exists between the two men over the course of the Civil War. Why is that?
Well, I think because basically Greeley sees himself as a bigger deal than Abraham Lincoln. You know, like a lot of people, especially kind of in the established Eastern world of kind of East Coast or Northeast politics, you know, Lincoln is this kind of nobody. And you know, Greeley sort of expects that Lincoln should kind of follow his instructions, should take his advice. And so, you know, there are all kinds of moments where Greeley, this kind of plays out in different ways. Their paths cross at one point in 1860 and, or late in 1860, early 1861, after Lincoln has been elected, and they're both on the same train, and Greeley refuses to go see Lincoln. You know, Lincoln is the president-elect, but Greeley thinks that Lincoln should come see him. You know, which again, just back to this idea that Greeley sees himself as kind of a bigger deal than Lincoln, and so Lincoln should show due deference to him. And this plays out through the Civil War, where Greeley kind of presumes to be able to tell Lincoln what to do. He writes letters to Lincoln, both private and public, sort of saying, this is what you need to, you're doing the wrong thing. You should just listen to me. So it's a very fraught relationship, and it's actually a very fraught relationship from the beginning. I should mention that that going back to Lincoln's election for Senate in 1858, or Lincoln's campaign for Senate in 1858, Greeley is kind of wishy-washy on whether or not he's actually going to support Lincoln when Lincoln is running against Stephen A. Douglas. And this is something that Lincoln and his, you know, and his cohort do not forget.
I was thinking about how Greeley's attitude mirrors in some ways that of another New Yorker of the time, which is William Henry Seward. I was thinking about how there seems to be that New York attitude of, you know, which is fascinating to see it in Greeley, given that very you know, fraught relationship that he has with his adopted hometown. But he seems to definitely, by the 1860s, have internalized the sense that, you know, you're a New Yorker, you can pretty much make those decisions for people.
Absolutely. Now Seward is another interesting figure for Greeley, because yes, they share this kind of imperious attitude toward Lincoln, particularly when Lincoln is just emerging. But Greeley has also fallen out with William Henry Seward by this point. They had a falling out in the 1850s over you know, political matters, and kind of in the midst of the breakup of the Republican of the Whig Party and the creation of the Republican Party. And then here's another kind of funny layer to all of this. Greeley is really an instrumental figure in doing in Seward's presidential aspirations, and Greeley throws his support behind behind Lincoln, basically to spite Seward, who he's had a falling out with. So this is all very complicated.
So how does Greeley respond to the Civil War over the course of it? Does he, to what degree is he trying to fit the events to his nationalism, and to what degree does his nationalism change in response to the fact that you have the most, dramatic, conflict and most dramatic challenge to nationalism in American history?
Yeah, Greeley has a hard time with the Civil War. That's probably the place to start. Lincoln sort of sums this up by 1864. He says, Greeley is an old shoe, good for nothing now, whatever he has been. And the basis for this is that Greeley becomes this really kind of unaccountable figure during the war. He is all over the place in his positions. You kind of get a case of whiplash after reading through his story of the war. There are moments when he seems like he's on the radical vanguard of the Republican Party in pushing for immediate emancipation. At others, he is flirting with crackpot ideas for peace on very limited terms and seems willing to kind of sell out the whole idea of emancipation. So it's like, what exactly does this guy believe? What exactly does he think? Because you can't really understand what he's doing. And the way I try to understand it in the Civil War chapter is to say that Greeley could only understand this event in these national terms that he understood everything in. That this idea that the Civil War had to be this kind of triumph of American nationhood, that had to be the outcome of this massive conflict. He's really kind of forcing this onto events that don't really fit that scheme. And so, I sort of think his inconsistency comes out of this effort to make the Civil War into this, the triumph of American nationhood, even though clearly it is a moment when the American nation has fundamentally failed.
And to what degree does this shape his post-war activities? Because you have this very, on the surface, very odd contrast with Greeley as a very much of a northern editor, a Yankee editor who has championed this vision of nationhood that the Southerners rejected, who after the war undertakes this dramatic series of steps, and most notably he bails out Jefferson Davis. I mean, so to what degree is it reflecting? Is it a product of that experience, of that effort to try to maintain that vision of nationhood?
Yeah. Well, so his kind of his understanding of this conflict shapes his again seemingly unaccountable and bizarre behavior and activity after it's over. If the idea of Horace Greeley going to bail out Jefferson Davis from jail is something that nobody could possibly have predicted or imagined if they were just thinking about the antebellum Republican Horace Greeley. Nor could they imagine Horace Greeley ultimately getting the Democratic Party's nomination for president in 1872. But again, this goes back to a lot of what we've talked about here. Greeley has this idea that there is this kind of core nationalism that exists across the country, exists among white Southerners, and he again thinks that if you just sort of can get to these people, if you can just speak to them the right way, you can kind of awaken this shared feeling that must be within them. And in the midst of his bizarre travels through the Reconstruction era until his death in 1872, he actually says that if we had just been able to reach these people before the Civil War, again, back to this idea, if they could just get them their copies of the New York Tribune, there really probably wouldn't have been a Civil War, because we could have had this kind of collective awakening. We could have empowered the non-slaveholding whites. We could have had a gradual and easy end to slavery, as opposed to this kind of destructive process, with the war and so on. So his path, his very bizarre path through Reconstruction is laid, is built upon the very bizarre path through the Civil War.
And yet it's also fascinating about what it says about this idea that he has of nationhood. I mean, it's impressive how committed he is to it throughout his career, as you demonstrate how, literally the country breaking apart doesn't cause him to shake it, doesn't shake it much.
Right.
And how he is trying to adopt, he sees this very much. This isn't about, Horace Greeley saying, I want to be president, although, he definitely, desires that, but he really is trying to, he sees this as part of achieving this vision of American nationhood, which, if anything, you make it clear now more than ever during Reconstruction, America needs to be thought of as a nation, as opposed to the still very much divided country that it was in 1872.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, as I say in the book, 4 years of just brutal civil war, 7 years of violent resistance to the results of the Civil War by white Southerners, they can't shake Greeley of these convictions that he has.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Sure. Well, that's a good question, because I've been a little bit all over the place and trying to figure out what I want to do next. I've had a few different ideas and have kind of been chasing down some different leads. But what I've been working on pretty consistently over the last few months, and seems to be the thing that I'm working on, is a project about New York City in the kind of between 1815 and 1850, or 1815 and 1860. I really, really enjoyed kind of getting into this world of New York City through Greeley. So, in the first chapter where I talk about his rise in journalism, I was very, very captivated by this history of New York City and its moment of becoming its moment of becoming the kind of the nation's metropolis, and everything that goes with that. And so my idea is for a project I'm calling Humbugs of New York, which is to take that was the name of a pamphlet that came out. I mentioned it in the book, a pamphlet that came out in, I think, 1837, to take certain characters who are phonies in some way or another, humbugs, and use them as a way to try to create this very, very bizarre thing that is rising up on the East Coast in this moment, and that place being New York City. So that's what I've been up to.
That sounds like a very fun project. I hope that when you complete it, we can have you back on the New Books Network to talk about it.
I'd be delighted.
Well, Jake Lundberg, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too, Mark. I really enjoyed this. Thank you.